This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
I'm Scott Kirshner, the at-large columnist for the Boston Globe. And earlier this year, I went to visit Jeremy Allaire, the founder and CEO of Brightcove Networks in Kendall Square, to see a demo of the company's software. It uses the internet to deliver high-quality video programming to a PC or a television set. Afterwards, we sat in Allaire's office to talk about how he identifies the most promising opportunities. I asked him to talk about how he started his first company, Allaire Corporation, which went public in 1999 and was eventually acquired by Macromedia for $360 million.
So I got introduced to the internet in 1990 when I was in school, like a lot of people. And it had been introduced to our campus, and I was, at the time, my background is political science, philosophy, economics, not a technical background, but certainly grew up technical. Was really transformed by it, and it was not so much that it was a great experience because it was command lines and cruising around, but it was what was most powerful to me was that, first of all, that there were these information sources all over, everywhere all over the world, and I could find access to them and acquire information on a geographic basis. But more important was I was actually studying international affairs and found that I was able to communicate directly with and acquire communication from people in, places that are in upheaval, in the Soviet Union, in China, in the Balkans, in mm-hmm. Haiti, in all these places. And it was a very, very powerful experience that for, at that point, essentially, kind of media and communications had been disintermediated, and I had access to that. So it was very clear to me at that point that this was kind of the future. So I spent basically the next 3 years with all my time on the internet, and so all my academic work centered around it, and I learned everything I could about it, and mostly around kind of socially and economically, and from a media and communications perspective, how was it going to evolve and become an important force? And it wasn't clear that it was going to be commercially viable at the time, but it was clear that it was a powerful thing. And in '93, I graduated from college and had no real valuable skills, and so I declared myself an internet consultant, which at the time meant, setting up people's dial-up connections and, and proselytizing to people who'd pay me, $75 an hour or whatever it was, like marketing agencies and PR firms who were like, oh, the information superhighway's here, we got to figure this out. So people would pay me to educate them, basically. But in 94, in the fall of 93, when the web came about, it was obviously incredibly transformative that this was going to be a catalyst for a real shift in how the internet would be used. And so from late 93, I was exclusively focused on the web, and in 94, really centered on the idea that the web was really going to be an operating system of sorts, that it was going to be an application platform, that you could build interactive services and communications applications and other things. It wasn't just a place to publish content. And so really centered on that idea and began working on projects, mostly in media, actually, that were geared towards using it as such. And so my brother and I collaborated closely on building some early online services for newspapers at the time and learned a lot about technically how does this work and mm-hmm. how do you build these applications. And I went on to work on another online service that was sort of for education and worked with my brother to figure out, how do we actually create some general tool to do this. So. Mm-hmm. My brother bared down and focused on the code and figured out a great way to create a basic engine. And it was clear out of that that this was going to be something that a lot of people needed, that it wasn't just, we were consultants, basically. There was a real commercial opportunity. And so by the summer, ColdFusion was released as a commercial product.
What did it do at that point?
At the time, it basically provided a way to take an HTML page and create a template, and then to connect that template to a database and insert data, query data, and dynamically format and render data into forms and into text. And it was done in a way which was very, very straightforward for anyone who kind of knew HTML, certainly anyone who had a programming background, but anyone who kind of knew HTML to do these things. And so the basic idea was the entire world should be able to build these kinds of online services. And so we were very mass market focused and built a simple tool that was easy to use, that would cost a few hundred dollars, and anyone could go and build these online services. You didn't have to be AOL or Prodigy or anything else to do it. Anyone could do this. And that was sort of the early commercial origins of the software and the business. And for me, it was you know, a shift to get into the software business. My interest was really in what was happening in online media, which was nascent at the time. But it turned out to be a good choice of where to focus time.
And did you do any of the classic, you know, market research stuff? I mean, did you try to size the market for the software? Did you do focus groups to talk about what features people wanted?
No. Yes and no. It was just absolutely obvious that this was going to be a huge disruptive platform, that everyone was going to need to do this. There was activity happening everywhere, and entrepreneurial activity everywhere. So there was no question that this was a great market. That doesn't mean we knew how to market or knew how to get distribution or do all the things that you need to do to build a business. But it's very clear that it was needed. And then in terms of a focus group, the focus group really was the first early customer. So I was sort of the customer for Cold Fusion, and I was the person saying, here's what I need to do to be successful on the web, and here are the things I need. And there was a core group of us, friends from college and others, that sort of centered around that. And so we learned
All of us were building websites for clients.
So that was the focus group, is what do we need? And so it was very real time. Literally, I need a feature, and I'd send an email to my brother, and he'd say, okay, and the next day, here's the build. And so it was a very iterative thing. And then that group grew, and then there was a beta, and so all of a sudden there were hundreds of people. And, you know, within the first year, there were 3,000 customers. And so that was a great focus group. They told us everything we need, and we were, you know, smart about having community and running public forums and really engaging with those people. And so we had transparency as a company and transparency in terms of what we were doing wrong or what people needed and so on.
Did you have a business plan?
No. We didn't have a formal business plan. It was, at one level, there was some small investment that went into the business. No real notion of when there'd be a return or whatnot, but
was it friends and family sort of investment?
Yeah, it was friends and family. We eventually had a boutique investment bank that put a little bit of money in, and then we raised venture capital in 1996 from Polaris Venture Partners when they were just getting started here in Boston with John Flynn, and then you know that was really at a time when it was sort of we were in our 20s and really didn't know the first thing about business or the software business, and it was clear that this thing was going to fall apart unless we got professional help, so to speak, which with both the venture capital and the network of the venture capitalists and the kinds of people we were able to then bring into the company made a huge difference.
So it sounds like you're saying you created a business plan when the investors asked you, hey, can we see a business plan?
Yeah, there was a sort of kind of formal thinking about what's the market and, you know, what's our business value proposition and how are we going to go to market. I mean, we definitely, we weren't totally flying by the seat of our pants. We understood a lot and had put together, you know, marketing and selling strategies and other things for what we were doing.
How did you sell the product?
The product was basically exclusively sold on the internet. And so it was a try and buy model. We did 30-day time expiring evaluations. We marketed on news groups and listservs and on download sites. I spent a lot of time out there communicating about it. Pretty much everything was word of mouth in terms of how adoption happened. We were very smart to very early focus on working with the kind of tech journalist community who was writing about the web and say, hey, here's what we're doing, and it's really great. And so we went and spent a lot of time there, and that was really probably the most effective use of our time to get a broader audience to know about what we were doing.
Did at some point Cold Fusion become boxed software? I mean,
it was always boxed software.
It sounds like you were a pioneer.
No, it was always boxed, actually. Uh-huh. So you actually couldn't buy it online.
Uh-huh.
You had to call a 1-800 number, and you got a pizza box. And actually, up on the shelf there, you can kind of see it behind those little trophies.
Uh-huh.
That white box.
Yeah.
That's the Cold Fusion 1.0 box. It's
uh-huh.
It's very, very plain. And that's it. There's a sticker on it, and so on.
What was it like as the company grew? I mean, it sounds like, actually, to ask a different question. So your vision was everyone would need this software. Everyone who's trying to build a website would need this software.
Yes, very much so.
How did that play out relative to other competitors? I mean, eventually.
Yeah. Well, early on, there were a few companies that were building things similar to us. Who didn't have quite as good a product. They were more complex. The documentation wasn't good. The whole user experience of the product wasn't that good. but we're priced somewhat similarly. We used early search engines to figure out, who's using what, based on the URLs that these products produced, and we were outselling everyone like 10-1. There were a couple of products that eventually came in that were kind of enterprise, and the positioning was enterprise applications on the web. But technically, they were actually simpler than what we were doing. It was just the selling model was it's $5,000 and it only runs on Unix, which was, kind of what big companies wanted to hear at the time. And some of those evolved and built pretty reasonable businesses. A company called NetDynamics ultimately was acquired by Sun. There were a number of small competitors that just disappeared and went away. The potentially most direct competitor was a company in Hawaii that had built a product that was kind of a clone. They had a first-generation product, which we were way superior to, and then they cloned ColdFusion, but they used Visual Basic as a way to program instead of a tag-based language, which we had innovated. And they were acquired by Microsoft, and 6 months later became what is known as Active Server Pages, or ASP. And that became really our biggest competitor.
What was it like competing against Microsoft?
Competing with Microsoft was difficult, but the internet ethos and the ability to be focused around the needs of web developers versus your legacy VB developers or Windows developers really allowed us to have a unique product and offer. Certainly, from a price point perspective, it's hard. Free versus $1,000 is hard. But what we found is that by being focused on an internet-centric programming language and...
You're saying they were free because... Microsoft was free because they were wrapping it up with other applications.
They were bundled in the web server, and the web server was ultimately bundled in the operating system and so on. And so, so their stuff was all free. But we had basically come up with a model that was more straightforward for the web. We were the first company to create a tag-based language, and ultimately XML emerged, and now tag-based languages are everywhere. And ColdFusion itself is now built on XML, for example.
But how did you motivate your people when you're saying, okay, this little company called Microsoft has something that they're integrating into the other products?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get people charged up about competing with them?
It was mostly the success of our customers and the enthusiasm of our customers, and so our customers just loved us. They loved our product. They constantly were doing amazing things, and they would write in about how they'd done it 10 times faster than with the Microsoft technology or 10 times faster than with Java or whatever it was, and so that was really exciting. It was always the customers that got us most excited.
How about the biggest challenge or kind of the darkest moment when you were starting, building, creating Alere Corporation?
I think the darkest moment was before we had venture capital. The company had been seeded. My brother put in a short change, whatever he had. I had no money. I was broke. I was, living on credit cards. My brother had a little bit of money, and he had kind of put in the money to start it. But basically, the company was operating on cash flow from the software sales, and we had grown to about 14 people. And so that's a lot to support. And so we were, we went for months and months without paying paying people, not everyone, but quite a few of us. And we had, a capital line with a bank, and it was possible that they were going to call it in. And so we were right on the face of kind of, basically not having the money to operate the company. And so we were quite terrified that we were to just have to shut down.
And why didn't you?
We managed to get venture capital.
Was that a difficult negotiation? I mean, everyone says don't negotiate with venture capitalists when your only other choice is turning off the lights.
It was not difficult. We actually had venture guys calling us for a while.
Why didn't you want to take it?
We did, and we went, and people that we talked to were terrified of tools companies, one. They didn't like software. They didn't like software tools, and they certainly didn't like software tools in Microsoft's backyard.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard to get people to want to do that. The investor that we did have, Polaris Venture Partners, and John Flynn, who's the partner, he had been the lead backer of PowerSoft, which had been a very successful company that had been part of a transformation to a new paradigm, client-server, and had been in Microsoft's backyard and done a phenomenal job. And so he wasn't terrified of it. And he saw that we had incredibly rabid, loyal customers. We had a growing business. We had, great product. And you know, you could do something with that. And clearly, the growth as a whole on the internet was going to be really substantial. And so it was not a huge risk.
The company eventually got acquired by Macromedia. Did you ever imagine, well, gee, maybe I could stay here at Macromedia as an executive for the rest of my life? Or are you not a big company guy?
No, definitely, definitely did think about that. Just sort of by way of history, we had flirted with merging with Macromedia for a number of years. It was a very attractive combination from our perspective and their perspective. We had an incredible base products that were kind of servers and programming tools and for developers, and they had an incredible base of products that were client runtimes, like their client runtimes like Flash, and then design tools. And so it was a natural fit. And so we flirted with it for a while. And I was very much an instigator of that and wanted to put those companies together and felt that it was kind of late 2000 when we did eventually make that happen. Felt that the combined companies would be much stronger than the individual companies, which turned out to be true and turned out to be a very good thing. So I joined Macromedia as the chief technology officer, and it was incredibly exciting work working on a kind of new platform for internet applications centered around Flash as a next generation runtime, and made huge strides in I think evolving what the internet is in terms of user experience and the kinds of applications people can build. It also personally allowed me to get closer to and back to my origin interests in the internet, which are really around media and media and communications. And it was exciting to be part of helping invent and drive those new types of platforms. So that was very exciting. And I think Macromedia is an incredible company. It is an incredible company. And
you must have at some point felt the itch to...
Yeah. Well, I did kind of get the bug. We had shipped a whole next generation platform called Macromedia MX, and I took a sabbatical. We were having a new baby and took a little time, and really went deep into video, and really went deep into imagining what original programming would look like with video, and using our software and Flash Video and other things, and imagining what kind of consumer video applications could be, and just really got excited about that. And wanted to make a run at that, and worked on a project inside of Macromedia around the area of kind of video publishing and video blogging and all that. And it was not going to be a product that clearly fit the Macromedia agenda, which was very much focused on establishing itself with an enterprise user base, building products that were focused on business professionals and business users, and a mobile strategy. And those have been incredibly successful, which is good. So Macromedia is doing very, very well. But I really, really wanted to get, into those spaces. And
this sounds like such a classic innovator's dilemma case study. You know what I mean?
Yeah, could be. I mean, the things that I was working on then are certainly now, a couple years later, now becoming truly, mainstream. And so, yes, a little bit of that. But it was also, I had incredible time working at a startup and building something. And it was very clear to me that there were a set of trends coming together around broadband and Wi-Fi and home networks and media formats like Flash and new device platforms and paid content and all these kinds of things that were happening that were going to be very big, and that the landscape of media distribution, richer media distribution like video, was going to be transformed. And so I wanted to find a way to think about and work on those things, but also kind of sample from what was happening in the entrepreneurial landscape. And so I went and spent time as a technologist and entrepreneur in residence at General Catalyst in Cambridge.
Right, yeah. Right. A relatively new venture capital firm. Your intention wasn't, you weren't attracted to becoming a full-time VC?
That is attractive, actually. Uh-huh. I mean, I won't deny that. I think the General Catalyst, I'll boast for them for a moment. I think they're unique in that they're very, very focused on helping build companies, and they are all operators and have built 20 companies themselves, and they hatch companies. They've started a bunch of businesses. They look at spaces that are not just high tech. And so it's a really creative environment to work on ideas. And I wouldn't rule out that I would ultimately to work on the investing side, only if I felt that I was actually working on building companies and helping build strategies and marketing strategies and product strategies and other things that are the really, really fun things, and work with a lot of great people. So it is attractive. But I definitely kept coming back to these ideas and coming back to the kinds of transformations that were happening, and couldn't help but think that it's like, you know, 1994 all again. There's all these things that are coming together, and there's going to be a lot of value created, and a lot of consumer experiences changed, and I really was taken by that and wanted to spend time on that.
So tell us about, I mean, while you were at General Catalyst, it sounds like you did a lot of studying and observation and saying, okay, here's how I might build a business around this internet of video, sort of an eBay-like marketplace for video idea. Just talk a little bit about that process and sort of how you saw this next opportunity.
Yeah. I spent time on a lot of different things. I spent time working on new sort of software as service models and e-commerce models, work in new consumer services that were centered around search, work in broadband video platform technology with another local company, Maven Networks.
And so was this all helping portfolio companies?
Absolutely,
at the venture
yes, firm? That's right. So helping them find investments, helping them put together teams, helping them work with portfolio companies. I spent quite a bit of time in a really fast emerging kind of pay media space, which is mobile content. And we looked at a lot of stuff in music and video and games, and helped help the company find its bearing in that space. And ultimately, they made a very large investment in probably the industry-leading company in mobile entertainment, Informa, which is an incredibly fast-growing company. So it was an opportunity to do that. And it was also an opportunity, you know, the Alera use experience was unique, but the reality of it was that I was, you know, 22, didn't really get the kind of exposure and learning that I would to really understand the variance that exist in startups and operating businesses and building teams and all those things. And so I would characterize, you know, spending a year plus in a venture firm as probably the most accelerated MBA program you could ever go through.
But it sounds like when you talk about seeing an opportunity, for you you learn a lot about an area, you kind of get your hands dirty in playing with the technology, and then it almost sounds like it's this inevitable feeling of, look, there's going to be a huge business here, I better get involved with it.
Yes, so that the tipping point for me was almost a little over a year ago. A lot of the themes were there, and it was at CES in early 2004, and Microsoft launched the Media Center 2005 platform, what they were going to be releasing 10 months, 11 months later. They kind of launched it, and it was very clear that they had put together a really compelling platform and architecture, and that it was sort of year zero in a transformation that was going to be a five-year transformation where new devices and platforms would exist that were open in the same way that the PC is open, in the same way that the internet is open, that would allow for the distribution of really rich forms of video and interactive programming to the TV and to the living room. And there certainly had been a lot of startups and other companies doing things in and around that, but none of them could you point to and say, oh, that's going to move the market. But when they stepped in and said, here's this end-to-end approach, it was totally obvious. And so it became clear that, okay, if there's a volume platform that's going to be established, this is going to be either it or one of them. And when combined with a lot of the other things I was very, very familiar with in streaming platforms and rich media advertising platforms and things that we had worked on at Macromedia, it was clear that you could put together an interesting business.
And so it's interesting that you went from Alera, where you were, you know, very much competing with Microsoft, to Brightcove, where you're saying, okay, how can we be a developer partner, a content partner with a Microsoft product?
Well, we were all, at Alera and Macromedia, it was always co-opetition. We were always, you know, Alera was the first company to aggressively support Windows NT as a platform. And we had the first, you know, really strong commercial server software for that platform. And they loved us. The guys that ran the NT group and the IIS group and the SQL Server group, they loved us. And we were there, we were getting early access, we were doing all this work. But then at the same time, you know, there were tools groups that were, you know, we want to kill you. And so we'd go out to Redmond and we'd meet with all these groups, and there'd be those that would be there, you know, clearly, you know, trying to suck our brains and figure out how they could kill us. and I won't recount some of the phrases and statements they made because they would reflect badly on the culture there. But you know, the
phrases and statements they made to you.
Yes.
Yeah. In front of you.
Yes. 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 But then other groups are just incredibly supportive and love what we're doing. Likewise,
was it like the mafia? Were they talking about concrete boots?
Not quite. You know, things like, if you're a couple $1 million, we don't care. You're just irrelevant. You know, if you're $10 million in business and you're in our space, then we'll pay attention to you and we'll pay attention. But we're not going to do anything, out of the normal. But if you start growing over $20 million, then we're going to crush you.
Uh-huh.
And we're just hitting that kind of revenue point, uh-huh. So the message was pretty clear.
Right.
In any case, they don't really take threats very seriously until they're, $100 million threats, probably, mm-hmm. in all honesty. And in Macromedia, the same kind of thing. We were all over supporting their latest operating systems, supporting a lot of their formats. We were the most successful provider of development tools for their browser platform, by far. I mean, we dominated that. And so there was definitely that. But at the same time, we were working on a new runtime that competed, in some respects, with Windows, the Flash runtime, which was an alternative runtime for client applications on the Internet. And so, yes, there's competitive piece, but there's also a lot of collaboration. And, I don't know what the competitive landscape looks like entirely for the new business that I'm working on at Brightcove, but we definitely are very aligned with Microsoft's view of the world and a lot of their technology, and expect to have good relationships with them on that basis. But they're also a media business, and they're also a multi-headed kind of beast, and so you have to expect that there will be parts of what they do that are competitive, whatever those might end up being.
Let me ask three last things real quick. Do you sometimes have ideas, in the general catalyst phase or in earlier phases of your life, do you sometimes have business ideas that you just kind of push and prod and analyze and say, that's just not going to work? And, mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that you mm-hmm. that you poke and prod at things
yeah.
to figure out,
yeah.
there's just not a business here or not a yeah. business that's interesting to you?
Yes, definitely. I think, for example, I spent quite a bit of time looking at personal media and personal media sharing. And clearly, everybody's got a digital camera, and they all share things in different ways. And I looked at tons of different businesses in that space and found some very good companies there. But ultimately kind of kept coming back to the conclusion that it was going to be almost impossible to build an independent company in that space, that it was sort of a utility that was going to be everywhere. There were kind of aftermarket opportunities around it, like Ofoto's done, printing stuff or things like that. But it seemed so natural that you'd be able to do it, but it seemed, as I pushed on it, just seemed so difficult to build a big business. You could build a small business, but build a big business I thought would be hard. As we looked at, and I spent a lot of time in mobile content, mobile games, things like that, there are lots of different businesses you could get into in that industry. And I think a lot of the startups in that space were a game developer and a game publisher. And that's a brutal business, but it's, and so, that was one area that looked, okay, maybe you could, build a business creating content for that, but it became
that felt too, like, hit-oriented.
Yeah,
to you,
very
like
much,
you
very,
die
yeah,
by.
Very hit-oriented, very, very difficult. There were, to mention that, you could see it kind of working, where you could have technical differentiation, or you could have great marketing partners or whatnot, but it became very clear that, you really wanted to be in the distribution and publishing business in that space. So sort of there are certain businesses that just became clear that's not a business that we'd want to get into. A space that's of interest to me and has been for some time is sort of personal video monitoring and using cameras everywhere to monitor things in a workplace, in a home, and sort of remote security applications. And a lot of the kind of convergent trends of home networks and Wi-Fi and cameras and internet video formats and other things make that possible. And looked at a lot of different businesses there, and it just felt like it was going to be also very difficult to build a really significant at-scale kind of business, that there were kind of channels established, like ADT and others, that really people relied on for home security, and that you know, those are going to be the guys that really build the big revenue stream there. Or there were device guys that were going to make money there, but that wasn't an attractive business to start.
So over the last few months, you've been laying the groundwork for Bright Cove and kind of building the team.
Yeah. For the last year, actually.
Last year.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it that gets you excited, jazzed up about starting a new company? I mean, what kind of, you know, what motivates you to, I presume, work the long, you know, the 10, 12, 14-hour days that it takes to do a startup?
Right. The biggest thing is just how exciting I think it will be to see the kinds of transformation that will happen in video and television distribution. I mean, it's just really exciting. You've got a $100 billion industry that is going to change over the next 10 years. And so it's economically exciting. I think we can create a lot of value. It's also just exciting to see that, to see an industry get transformed and to be part of it and to kind of make a dent, if you will. There's definitely a deeper motivation, which is sort of democratic values around media, and that's a very, very core part of even Allaire and what we did with ColdFusion. It's a core part of this, and so I am a deep believer in the kind of democratization of tools of media and communication, and aim to accomplish that, and to see the fruits of that as well is very personally motivating.
Is speed and kind of the ticking clock part of it? I mean, do you feel like, you know, with eBay, I think, you know, look, there were lots of other companies that tried to create an auction marketplace, and eBay was there very early, and they kind of established a beachhead. I mean, do you feel that being first is kind of important with this company? You know, to kind of create the marketplace for video content?
I don't think being first is as important. I think there have been, I've learned a lot just from my experiences over the last decade to see that you can get into markets that are maturing or mature and still build great businesses. So I don't think it's as binary as that. And I think there's enough variance in the different types of businesses that will get built in kind of consumer video services and online video services that... that there's room for a lot of different types of opportunity.
But won't people flock to the one that has kind of all of a sudden has the seems to have the most content and has some critical mass?
So clearly there will be a couple of, you know, a few really breakaway successes, right? And there will clearly be big companies that are already portals or in other significant retail businesses that will make the cross the chasm and, or get into these businesses. So it's not... it's not like everyone's going to survive this, and there will be big winners. Would be great to be one. But I'd be happy with just something that's reasonably successful.
Really?
Wow.
That's surprising.
Yeah, I mean...
You don't look at eBay as the model? I mean, eBay is a pretty phenomenally successful company.
Clearly, you can, you know, eBay, Amazon, Google, Yahoo, I mean, these are all tremendous companies.
But you don't visualize being one of those companies?
I certainly visualize being one of those companies. I set the bar very high. At Allaire, we set the bar at being the next operating system. You know, we wanted to be the new platform for applications. So we had a very high bar. We came so far. We didn't go all the way. We never became a Netscape tier of, that's not the best analogy, but, we built a great business. We built a $120 million public company. That was great. So I was incredibly happy with that success. But the bar was actually higher, right? So, I mean, there are a lot of levels that you can get to.
Right. No, I just wanted to be clear. I mean, it sounded like you were just saying, well, you know, if there are three or four
players, we're happy
to be one of the, you know, somewhere in the mix.
No, we're very, very focused on being a great, great successful company.
And the one thing I wanted to come back to is, so when you were at Allaire and you were doing this first round of venture capital, I just am surprised that you say, okay, we're about to run out of money and turn off the lights. People were working with no salary. And you're saying, we feel like we had leverage in doing that round of venture capital.
Well, I didn't say we felt like we had leverage. I just think that we managed to find investors who were good business people who saw a good opportunity and wanted to work with us to build something interesting. And they were partners in a business versus, look at this, we could squeeze these guys. You know,
but they were kind of dictating the terms of valuation.
I won't disclose the terms. We ended up getting on a kind of competitive market of looking at at venture deals, we got a very good deal.
But you don't recommend to other entrepreneurs that's when you want to negotiate with your VC when you're about to turn out the lights.
No, there are a lot of different... No, that's right. That's right.